delay in our starting here, but we do have representing Moses, representing Paul, got us on here, okay. Co-chairman Chenault, myself, co-chairman Meyer, representative Jewell, representative Hawker, and there's others that will be coming shortly. Before we get into PPT, there is one bill yet in the finance committee that I know the sponsor would like us to get out of committee. She's promised me it would be 5-10 minutes at the most. Has nothing to do with PPT either, does it? Senate Bill 169, workers' comp records. So if we could take that up quick, and then we'll send Heather on her way, and I'll turn the gavel over to Co-Chairman Chenault. So, Heather, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Heather Brake, staff to Senator Terrio, sponsor of Senate Bill 169. As introduced in 2005, Senate Bill 169 prohibited the Division of Workers' Compensation from assembling and providing information relating to individual records outside the scope of the Workers' Comp Act. That section was later incorporated into another bill and enacted through Chapter 10, FSSLA 2005. However, in a recent case, Kubler v. Lesenke, the Alaska Superior Court found that the statute was ambiguous. Further, it found that the public right to access information outweighed an individual's right to privacy absent a solid argument from the state in that litigation. The court found that the state did not submit any solid legislative intent or history on the matter. Senate Bill 169 is an attempt to clarify the legislature's intent on that provision. Because the court found that there was no legislative record providing clarity as to whether the privacy concerns that the director referred to are the concerns of the employer or the employee, nor was it clear that what those concerns are, was the quote from the court. And so, Mr. Chairman, we want to make it very clear that the state may not give out your personal information in these cases unless you so choose, and that's what Senate Bill 169 does at this point. If there are any technical questions, the Director of Workers' Comp, Paul Lesenke, is here as well.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Briggs. Any questions? Okay. did you want to testify or just for questions or for the amendment?
Questions only, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lesenke. Lesenke.
Correct. For the record, I am Paul F. Lesenke, Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation in the Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
You would think by the end of the session here, I'd know how to say your name. My apologies. Okay, for the record, Representative Kelly has joined us, as well as Representative Stoltz. Okay, if there's no questions, let's go ahead and take up Amendment 1. And Amendment 1, looks like it's my amendment, so I'll move it.
Object.
Okay. Can somebody explain my amendment?
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number one would add Social Security number to page 2, line 6. It was just an oversight that was left out, and that would bring it into conformity with the language that was added on page 1, lines 5 and 6. The Department of Law felt that it was necessary to, for consistency, to add that in. So,
okay. Good. Any questions? Do you maintain your objection?
Yeah, no, now that I've read it, I don't.
Okay. Objection has been removed. Any other objections to Amendment 1? Seeing none, Amendment 1 is adopted. We now have the bill back before us as amended. Any questions? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Stoltz, you want the honors?
Oh, move it out?
Yeah, let's go ahead.
Chairman, I move that CS for Senate Bill number 169, Judiciary, as amended by the committee, the report out of the committee with the attached fiscal note.
Zero fiscal note.
With individual recommendations to committee.
Any objections? Seeing none, the bill passes out of committee. Thank you. Let's see, who's joined us here? We have Representative Petrula, we have the Minority Leader, Representative Berkowitz. I think we've captured everybody else. So at this time, I'll turn the gavel over to Co-Chairman Schnultz.
Thank you,
Representative Weirach. Here, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, we'd like to bring up CS for Senate Bill 305, Finance. I would need a motion to adopt the blank CS.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hawker.
Sir, I move before the committee for discussion, work draft for House CS for CS for Senate Bill number 305, Finance. That would be version 24-GS2052/N. That would be the Chenoweth version, 5406, sir.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. Are there any objections?
Object for discussion so that we can hear the presentations.
Sure. Well, we plan on the presentation as soon as we adopt the CS.
Well, I still object to the adoption of the CS until we hear everything from the presenters.
Okay, that's fine.
Thanks.
It's intent now to, since there is an objection, if I could have Robin Wilson with Department of Revenue and Dan Dickerson to come forward. They will introduce the blank CS, work us through the changes, and as we proceed, I doubt there's probably very many questions, but I'm sure there'll be a few. We will work through those questions, and then we'll look at adopting the CS. Okay, you'll find it. Okay, free that brief at ease. If you would continue with the comparison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Robin Wilson. I'm the Director of the Tax Division for the Department of Revenue. And what I'd like to do today is to give you four or five key points on the CS before you, and then walk through, I believe, the comparison chart that you have, and finish up with walking through the bill, and I'll draw your attention to the parts as we go through it. The CS before you, one of the main elements is it's a tax rate of 20%, a credit rate of 20%. Date of July 1st. It has a progressivity tax that is based on net, and I'll go into the details of that in a few moments. The base allowance, a credit provision, has been retained from the House Resources CS. And cook inlet oil and gas is specially treated. So those are sort of the key pieces right off the beginning. So then moving in the through the chart, which I believe you have before you as well,
Sorry. Okay. Two copies for you guys.
Yes. Okay, there are copies for the audience. Representative Weinbach.
There's this May 5th document. Did you hand that out? Is that a handout as well? From the
I believe.
Yeah, it's on HB 488. Is that right, or it should be SB?
To the chair, Representative Weinbach, the title is incorrect. That is for today's. I've prepared a few graphs showing tax effects.
It's right here.
Yeah, no, really dynamic.
It does say draft.
Get one from the end of the way up to 305.
Okay. Everybody got a copy?
No. No. Luann will give me one. We need copies for the Representative.
Okay.
Before we start, how do you want to handle questions? Do you want to get all the way through the presentation, or should we just
If there's a question, we'll stop and try
to
get that section, and we can move forward.
Thank you.
Okay. It's like my desk in the chambers.
Yes, thank you. As I mentioned a moment ago, the general tax rate on the CS before you is 20%. There is a three-quarter revenue exclusion for Cook Inlet Oil. Now, if you'll recall in the Senate version, which you've had testimony on prior in this committee, in the Senate version, there was a revenue or value exclusion for gas. It's been referred to as the GRE. Technically, it's not a revenue exclusion. It is a value exclusion, but people have sort of used a shorthand of GRE on the gas. The Senate handled Cook Inlet Oil by providing a special tax rate of 5% on net. There were technical problems with that and practical problems because there was no provision for allocation of cost. So 5% of the net taxable value of Cook Inlet Oil did not have a meaning under that bill. So there were problems with that. This CS takes that 5% of net out and then uses a method similar to the GRE, where three-quarters of the revenue is excluded. So excluding three-quarters with a 20% tax rate would get to an effective tax rate before deductions of 5%. On Cook Inlet Gas, you want to...
Mr. Chairman, if I might make an observation on that. Excuse me. For the record, my name is Dan Dickinson. I'm consulting with the Department of Revenue on this. And when we looked at the CS last night and this morning and worked that through, I mean, even though the observation that one quarter of 20 is 5% is true, because of the way one was net and one was gross, the effect of this does come out with a significantly lower tax rate on Cook Inlet Oil than the 5% would. And Mr. Chairman, I can talk about that more. I can give you a very simple example, which I can hand out when we come back on this and get to it.
Okay. Cook Inlet Gas is treated specially in this CS before you. There is a tax ceiling, not a tax rate, but a tax ceiling of 19 cents per MCF on gas coming out of the inlet. The credit rate is 20%. That is the CapEx credit rate, 20%. And the private royalty rate, the Senate language has been adopted, which provides 5% on oil and 1.67% on gas. And that is also, there's a provision for a report from the commissioner on those provisions. As I said a moment ago, the gas revenue exclusion, or actually value exclusion, that was in the Senate bill has been incorporated into this bill, and that's whereby two-thirds of the gross value is excluded on gas.
Representative Kurtula.
Thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to understand that. So is it, you know, 6.67 or one-third of the 20% tax rate, or is it that it's just one-third of the gas is taxed at the 20% rate? How does that work?
It is accomplished in Section 160, which right. defines net value, and so what happens is two-thirds of the value is excluded, and then the remaining one-third is taxed
at the 20%.
Yes.
Okay, except for the Cook Inlet.
Correct.
With Cook Inlet, do the credits that come in with Cook Inlet, can they be used anywhere, or can they only be used against Cook Inlet?
Through the Chair, Representative Kurtula, it's a statewide tax system. The credits
on
can
that.
Be used anywhere.
Okay, thank you.
Progressivity piece, you may recall one of the versions, and I believe it was Senate Finance, CS or draft CS, had a progressivity based on net. In contrast, the House Resources CS progressivity was based on gross. So in the CS, the progressivity is based on net, but the trigger point has been increased and the slope has been increased in comparison to the former Senate progressivity on net.
Point of clarification.
Representative Carter?
You said trigger point has been increased. Did it go up or down in terms of dollars?
Thank you. Through the Chair, Representative Hawker, you're absolutely correct. I misspoke. The trigger point has been brought down from what was $45 net to $35 net.
Thank you.
Thank you.
$45 gross, not $45 net. Okay. Never mind. Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Representative Stahl. At today's oil prices, say $70, whatever they change quickly. What would be the effective tax rate with this progressivity? I mean, is it closer to 25, 26, 27%? Do we know that?
Co-Chair Myers, at $70, we calculate it would be about 25%.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Kurtula.
Why the progressivity on net? I mean, what's the policy for doing a progressivity on net rather than on the gross?
Through the Chair, Representative Kurtula, clearly it is a policy call. And I think you may have heard some of the pros and cons that we've talked about in various committees. A progressivity based on net does recognize costs. Are represented better in under the net. However, when you have it on gross, then you can accommodate, for example, differences in proportionate value between oil and gas. That's one key difference. If you're looking for sort of a windfall profit piece that is dependent on the price of oil, then probably progressivity based on gross is a better plan. If you're looking for a progressivity based on, you know, the company's profit, high profits, then you may be looking probably more at net. In the various CSs we've seen it obviously both ways. Do you have anything further to add on that?
No, I think that summarizes it. And the only other point I would make is several effects. One of them is as costs increase, or as they change between, say, a heavy oil and a light oil, the looking at net, in fact, will recognize that difference. Whereas if you look at gross, if the price is $70, $70 triggers it, and so if it's cost you $20 to get that barrel out of the ground, you'll have a smaller margin, whereas if it's cost you $10 to get it out, you'll have a larger margin.
Representative Tula.
But we've already done net on everything else. I mean, so it seems to me that, you know, that's where that all gets accounted for, and that this would just be so much simpler if the progressivity, at least, you know, was something that was, it would be simpler to just do it that way. So I'm still kind of struggling with this.
Yeah. Representative Petrullo, through the chair, for the record, Dan Dickinson. I think in terms of simplicity, this now means that you have the same tax base for the 20% and for the progressive increment. So in that sense, it is simpler. You don't have to calculate two different bases and two different rates. The argument can be that the calculation of the progressivity itself is probably simpler, but it probably takes more work. So I don't know if there's a particular right answer to that question.
Thank you.
And as I said, because the progressivity is based on net value of all oil and gas in the state, that means that there is no special gas progressivity, whereas in the House Resources CS, if you'll recall, there was a particular progressivity on gas because it was on the gross. There's one progressivity for oil and one for gas.
Representative Jewell.
Just a question. You know, we recognize on the tax rate, we're going, you know, that's net based on net, and in the and you're recognizing certain costs there as well through, you know, all your deductions and credits. And I guess my question is this: through the progressivity, do you get to recognize those costs again?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, looked at one way, perhaps that is true, but it is a different measure, and I would sort of equate it to, you can claim depreciation on your corporate income state income tax return and your federal corporate income tax return. You're not really deducting it twice. You have two different measures. And so in this bill, you now have two different measures. You have the basic PPT rate and the progressivity. They are both taken against the same net value, the same measure. So in that respect, it is not taking it twice, but it is it's using the net value twice for a tax calculation.
Thank you.
The next question is the deductibility of the progressivity tax. And so under all of these bills, the progressivity is a separate tax. You have the PPT basic tax of 20%, and the progressivity is a separate tax. So the natural question then is, well, can that be deducted against the PPT? And in the CS before you, it cannot be deducted for the net value. Transition, and just to remind folks that this was originally called a look back, a claw back under the governor's bill. It has evolved, and under this CS, it adopts the Senate language, which provides a 5-year look back on capital expenditures, but provides for a 2-for-1 recoupment. So for every $2 you spend, you can then recoup a dollar. That is a 20% credit, the same as the CapEx credit. And I point that out only because under the Senate, it was a different credit amount than the general credit. Okay. The sunset is a 7-year sunset. I would draw your attention, it is a rolling sunset in this CS. And what that means is for a company that is not in commercial production yet, but will be a year or two or three down the road, their 7 years doesn't start until the beginning of their commercial production. The base allowance, this in the governor's bill, I'll remind people, was a $73 million deduction. Under the House Resources CS, it was a $12 million credit, not a deduction. And in the Senate version, it was a 5,000 barrel calculation. It was under the Senate version, it was based on barrels, not a straight tax credit. In the CS, the House language is retained as $12 million credit. But we've also heard discussion about a so-called gold plating problem because the $12 million is based on current investment, as is the CAPEX credit. And so there were questions about then basically subsidizing more than 100% of a particular investment. That's what's referred to as the gold plating problem. This version, this credit is only available up to half of the current investment. So what that means is if a company is investing $12 million currently, they could only take $6 million of this credit. If they invested $24 million currently, they could have the whole $12 million credit.
Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to get on the record here. I appreciate you going back to a fixed credit or the committee process, taking us back to a fixed credit amount. I feel that's a better basis. But as we're trying to deal with the gold plating solution here, it appears to me that we've achieved something we didn't intend to, which I think this mechanism punishes small producers and benefits larger producers. Something on this particular section, Mr. Chairman, I think it's problematic, but it's not something we can't overcome, and I do appreciate your commitment to work on this section with us.
Thank you, Representative Hawker, and the intent was to look at the gold plating without affecting the smaller producers, so we're currently working on a fix for that to eliminate both the gold plating and allow the tax credit.
Thank you, sir.
And the base allowance is provided a 10-year sunset, and that too is a rolling sunset under this bill. Again, under the same theory as the one I talked about a minute ago. The safe harbor, the Senate language has been adopted, and that is a 95% requirement to be paid with an annual true-up. And if 95% is paid monthly, then there is no interest. If a company pays less than 95%, then there would be interest on the difference between what the company paid and the 95%. If the company does not pay 95%, there is interest. There is no penalty in the CS.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And why no penalty?
Through the chair, Representative Meyer. There are general penalty provisions in the general administration section of the statute. I believe it was felt that there should not be a special penalty for this, that interest was sufficient. Under the Internal Revenue Code, there are estimated tax penalties per se, but they are nothing more than interest. Okay. The effective date, as I said before, is July 1st in this bill. And the bill also provides that for the first 6 months, a company can pay under the old system, that is the ELF system currently in place, but in the seventh month must calculate the liability that would have been recorded had the new rules been in place and true up at that time.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Repeating a dialogue we've had here before in previous context on the same issue, that's 6 months for the department to get all its regulations in place, interpreting this, providing the public comment period, getting them out, response, finalizing the regulations, and giving the people that are going to be paying sufficient time to get their accounting structures evolved to comply with the regulations. Can you assure me that the department can accomplish its goal within 6 months and provide a reasonable window of opportunity for the payers to comply?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, as I've previously testified, I cannot give you 100% certainty. We anticipate hiring some contract help to get the regulations done. We see it as a reasonable amount of time. But if you're asking for 100% certainty, then I would say the answer is probably no.
I won't ask you for a probability calculation.
Thank you. Is the Department of Revenue the only department that does those audits, or does DNR also have auditors that is capable of doing audits? So is there any reason for two departments to do auditing?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, I believe your question kind of has two parts. The transition provision that we're talking about, the 6 month, the primary push during that period would be writing regulations, and the Department of Revenue would be responsible for writing those regulations. It is true that the Department of Natural Resources has auditors, and both sets of auditors do audit the value. And does that answer your question, or?
Yes, and I'm asking the question in the wrong place, I think.
Okay. Representative Jewell, through the chair, if I might. The DNR, they have the same standard that is in the current law, which is they're looking at the gross value at the point of production. So both DNR and the Department of Revenue audit the cost between the West Coast and Pump Station 1. The change here to net now goes to the upstream costs. And those, we get our royalty free and clear of costs. So there is no current program in which those costs are being audited, other than in net profit share leases, which constitute a very small piece. So the additional obligations that this statute will put on the Department of Revenue are not shared by another department.
Okay.
Okay. The spill surcharge that is currently in Section 201 and 300, which is referred to as the split nickel, under current law, there is 2 cents suspended and 3 cents collected. The CS maintains the same total of 5 cents, but decreases the 201 surcharge, so 1 cent would be suspended, and increases the collected surcharge from 3 cents to 4 cents, thereby increasing the collected amount by a penny.
Thanks. Have you run this by DEC? I mean, we just had to take the cruise ship fund to make it through this year. So I know in our subcommittee we talked about trying to fix this situation, but, I mean, the Senate had, you know, pushed it up even that other cent. I don't know. Has DEC worked with you to show them their figures and what they really project out that they really are going to need?
Representative Jewell, through the chair, you know, we have not done analysis on that piece on this bill.
Maybe we could get DEC in.
Right, that would be appropriate. We have not looked at
okay,
that.
Okay, yeah.
We do have somebody from DEC here if they want to.
It's Mike here.
Come up.
Or Larry.
Yeah. Why don't we go through the bill and we'll come back to
you. Okay, sure.
We'll come back to the split nickel. Okay.
The surcharge, the spill surcharge treatment is not creditable and not deductible, and that is the same as it was in the Senate bill and the House resources. This bill also extends the SB-185 exploration credit for 10 years, and it adopts Senate language which fixes a problem that's in the current statute right now. So there's some language fix in there regarding the $20 million cook inlet limit.
Under the bill,
there is no deduction or credit for abandonment on facilities that basically old production. So if a facility produced oil both before and after the effective date, then there's a formula contained in the language to allocate the expenses of abandonment, and those expenses incurred for production before the effective date then are not deductible.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, could I ask a question? So you've split it so that the old is not allowed, but new production you would allow the abandonment costs. Is that right?
Correct.
And, I mean, I've only been through the bill once myself, but did you deal with any of the issues that Representative Chenault had raised earlier about, you know, how we deal with abandonment if it's done once or twice or three times, and how we, you know, how we work with that kind of a situation.
Through the chair, Representative Kutula, the language is improved from the Senate version, but I don't believe it's been expanded to the extent you're talking about.
And one other thing, and I know that we're going to have to quit here soon, so maybe something that you don't know and I can get from someone else, but are abandonment costs figured in when somebody's coming in to explore or to get into new production? I mean, is that really a cost that we, you know, is figuring into that? I mean, is it really rightfully at play here? I mean, I the way I thought of it is it might not be, but...
Representative Kutula, through the chair, if I might, the yes. I mean, I think when people look at the full cycle of what's going to happen, they're going to take on a lease, and they know when that's done, they're going to have to plug and abandon and leave that. In fact, I believe that one of the large uncertainties is exactly what those costs will be, because I think the standard of remediation has been evolving rapidly over the past several decades, and may continue to evolve, and so there is a folks look at that. That's one of the things they have to estimate and put into their full cycle costs, and they will not leave out any costs that they do not, you know, if they think they're going to incur a cost, they're going to put it in their economics. Otherwise, they're not going to be doing good economics.
I just don't know how they know what those will be when they're going to be so many years out. Do you have anything that you could show me on that? I mean, any backup on that?
Representative Kutula, through the chair, I mean, we certainly have estimates that have been made in certain points in certain contexts. I'd have to look and see whether they're, you know, confidential or not. But, I mean, the difficulty of estimating it doesn't mean that you will leave it out of your economics. It means it will define a range in your economics. Clearly, if it's something very far out and you're doing it at a discount rate, it may not play a huge part in your initial economics. But how that's dealt with is important, and it'll be in there.
Okay, I'm concerned about that. Thank you.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Robin, on the 185 credits, the extension of the sunset, we had a double or triple dip potential. Did we solve that? Is that deductible against income taxes or just PPT tax?
Chair Representative Kelly, the zero under the PPT foreign exploration expenditure, you can claim a credit under the PPT 024 or under 025. Now, if there's a 20% credit under this bill, under SB 185, a producer or an explorer can get up to a 40% credit, but it is based on mileage, distance from current wells, and so on. So there's particular requirements that would enable an explorer to get a 40% credit. So you're not, for any dollar of exploration costs, you're not going to claim it twice under 025 and 024.
And Representative Kelly, if I might, if you don't want to get down the specific tab, but on page 7, line 30, what that does is that says, and this is in the 024, where most of the credits in this bill are, what that line does is that identifies the four programs for additional programs. Two of them are in royalty. You'll see that's AS38 and AS41, so royalty programs. The next one is AS4320. It's a specific income tax credit tied to certain kinds of development. And then AS4355025, and that is where SB185 ended up. So basically this says is, if you have taken a credit under any one of those programs, you cannot take it under 024.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay.
And if I might just, that was an additional piece of language. We saw that potential problem, and so that is a change from the House CS, the House Resources CS, to this one, to add those extra provisions, the extra sections in there. Okay. The next thing is whether the credits, to what extent the credits are usable, and under the bill before you, and indeed all the prior versions that had a progressivity piece, the credit, the CapEx credit, is not available to offset the progressivity tax. It is creditable only against the basic PPT tax. Maintains the position of having credits transferable, and that only 20% of the purchaser's tax liability can be offset. That has not changed in this bill. The House Resources CS did provide for up to $10 million of credits to be refundable. This version does not provide for refundable credits, and that is taken from the Senate's language, or there's basically no provision in either the Senate version or this one about refundable credits, so there are no refundable credits. At any annual loss, a credit would be available at the end of the year, and that's just converted to from a loss to a credit based on the tax rate, so that provision has not changed.
Representative Cotrulla.
So how many times can a single expenditure be deducted and credited both? I mean, if we count in the ways that it happens. It's a deduction, it's a credit, it's...
To the Chair, Representative Cotrulla, under the PPT bill, a capital expenditure can be deducted, and there's also then the 20% credit.
Federal tax, it would also come off?
That is correct. It would come off under the federal tax, though you would see that capital investment being depreciated over the useful life.
And do you know what the total percentage is that it would result in being deducted finally, including the federal tax, how many times that would go through?
Through the Chair, Representative Cotrulla, no, I don't. We've used a top marginal rate of 35% for federal tax. Now, in the state corporate income tax, it would also be deducted, but in that arena, worldwide income is apportioned. So any particular deduction would be apportioned based on companies' business in Alaska compared to everywhere else. So if a company has a 5% apportionment factor, then 5% of that deduction, you know, would flow through, and the top state marginal rate is 9.4%.
So corporate income, deduct credit, federal, and maybe you could come back and tell me what you think that really results in the percentages. I mean, if you maybe just use an example for me at some point.
6:30.
Thanks.
On this point, if I might, Mr. Chair, I mean, but we're dealing here with different tax systems that are being applied to the same taxpayer. I think there's a very good case to be made that you're not getting five deductions for the same item compounded, but in different circumstances, you're allowed to treat the same expenses for different tax purposes. And if we take a look at just, and I'd ask you to think about presenting just the algebra of the PPT equation. When you look at, essentially, you can restructure the algebra to state, yes, you're getting 20% of your qualified capital expenditures as a direct credit. You also, if you parse the algebra on the PPT calculation itself, you're taxing 20% of the revenue, you're allowing 20% of the CapEx expenditures to be deducted. So I really refute the interpretation that this is truly a double dipping, but it's a, you know, compound formula that however you spin it algebraically, you can use it to your political advantage.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just add something to answer Representative Cotrulla's original question as well. If you use a deduction, you take a deduction, and that lowers your tax. The only reason you would ever convert that into a lost credit was because you weren't able to use it. And so simply, if you have an unused deduction, you say, it sounds like we're saying, oh, gee, you get it as a deduction, and then you roll it forward, and it becomes a kind of lost credit, so you took it twice.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's not a fair way of looking at it. You're allowed to take it as a deduction. You have $100 in revenues, you have $200 in costs. Well, you can only use $100 deduction of those costs, brings you down to zero. the exercise stops, then that other $100, real costs, now get carried forward as a $20 credit to apply in the next year. But the point is, you've only used the costs once, even though it showed up as a deduction when you could use it and when you couldn't use it. The mechanics of carrying it forward was the credit.
Well, I thought I understood that.
Go back. Let me ask a question about the carry forward since you mentioned it. There's no time limit on these carry forwards, am I right? On you know, the regular deductions and credits. There's no time. What happens if we have a low oil year and all of a sudden we get hit with all of these carry forwards? I mean, is there any way that we can do something to protect against that? I mean, if you've got a whole bunch of carry forwards coming forward, you know, you get into, I mean, God forbid, but, you know, that's something I'd really like to have some protection against happening.
Representative Curtula, through the chair, if I can just, you know, if you look at the end of the tax, go out far enough, at some point, when higher margin, you know, you've all done sort of economics 101, when your marginal cost equals your marginal revenue. I mean, there's going to be a point at which the costs will simply overwhelm the ability to produce. There will be no PPT, and credits will, in a sense, will stack up. What you're talking about, and will simply never, they will never be charged against any revenue due to the state. The revenue will go to zero. What you're looking at is what if you had a situation where there was a large investment and prices fall. And the way this system has been designed is your PPT revenues could be reduced to zero,
right?
Just as they would, under. And if you had sustained low prices and continued investment, or a large investment had to be worked off, yes, that would be continued to be sustained. When prices rise, then you would once again be collecting revenues.
But there's nothing in it right now to protect us against that scenario.
For Tula, through the chair, I think if you're getting investment and you're refunding the investment, there is no guarantee that we will receive revenues even when those investments are not profitable. That's correct. This is a profits tax, and there have to be profits to be taxed.
Well, but it's not only the profits. It's this problem with the rolling forward. So it's just, I want to flag it because I still think there must be some way that we can deal with that.
Well, Representative Petrillo, through the chair, if I might, I mean, profits aren't an annually, a year-by-year thing. If you have a loss in 1 year, and then that to actually figure out how much you have made off your investment, it is necessary to roll forward and look at it in consecutive years, and profits up, profits will be down.
I understand that, but I don't want to see a situation where we have all of these carry forwards coming in and seeing the state without any revenue. So, I mean, that's not so far-fetched. So I'd like to see some, you know, if we can think about some way to protect against that. Thank you.
Representative Tua, through the chair, if I might, we have been very careful, tax, property tax, or both. So the point is, we shouldn't look at this as the only piece, the only way the state derives revenue from oil and gas. This is one of four, and what this is going to be do is when it's more attuned to profits, it will be making more than the others at higher prices, but at lower prices, as you correctly observe, this number could be much smaller.
Go ahead, Robin.
Oil production.
We've added a definition to clarify that. And DNR value, I guess, is the next item on the chart. And what that is, the provision that was in the House Resources CS, whereby the Department of Revenue can look to RSA values to establish gross value. Through one of the versions that I've seen in the various committees, there was language added to that provision which said that the Department of Revenue had to determine that the use of RSA values was cost efficient and did not systematically lower a producer's tax liability. That language has been inadvertently, I believe, left out of this provision in this bill, and I believe you will see amendment later today to restore that. What that language does is place a responsibility on the department to determine that an excess of tax is not being lost. if the department sees that the RSA value is materially different, then the department cannot allow that producer to then utilize the RSA values.
Could I go back just to the point of production for a second? I saw the new definition, but I wasn't sure exactly what the, you know, how it's going to work now. We've got, what, treatment plant and production. I figured Mr. Mintz could respond. Could you just explain to me now what we're going to have as the point of production?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cotula, for the record, I'm Robert Mintz. Until recently, I was with the Department of Law, and now I'm in private practice working with the Department of Law on production tax legislation.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I think the main change that is reflected in the committee substitute is a refinement of the definition of gas treatment.
I couldn't hear.
A refinement of the definition of gas treatment. The chair will recall that the basic legislation moves the point of production downstream of gas processing as compared to current law, but it clarifies that gas treatment, which is essentially getting gas ready to be transported, is still downstream of the point of production. There was a concern raised by industry that gas treatment was overly broadly defined because it could include field dehydration, which in some cases is necessary for production operations or for gas processing. And so the committee substitute clarifies that field dehydration or scrubbing out of liquids at the entrance of a gas processing plant is not part of gas treatment.
And that's the only part? That was what I was really having a hard time understanding last night. So that's the only part of gas treatment that's now upstream? Or did we move the whole gas treatment?
No, that's correct. Now, there's some other refinements in the language which aren't intended to have a material effect. For example, we now have a definition of gas processing plant separately from gas processing. It was also pointed out that although the bill had a definition of gross value at the point of production, the bill also uses the term point of production separately, and it would be desirable to define point of production separately. So now the CS has definitions for gross value at the point of production and definitions for point of production, but they're intended to be consistent with one another.
Okay, moving on then. The Senate version had a provision that would allow the Department of Revenue to write regulations that would incorporate the provisions of Internal Revenue Code Section 482. And if you'll recall, that IRC 482 is the provision that deals with transfer pricing issues. And in the federal arena, that typically shows up where there's transactions between a domestic company and its foreign affiliate. There were concerns raised here that perhaps there could be transactions between affiliates that would result in overstatement of costs, and so that provision was incorporated in the Senate bill to allow the department to have a tool to deal with it. I would just note that the Senate version also included the incorporation of regulation or of Internal Revenue Code 6662, which involves valuation, and it also talks about a federal penalty. That 6662 has been removed in this CS, but this CS retains the 482 language. Next item on the list is the catastrophic oil spill, and just kind of walking back through sort of the history on this bill. The original bill, as presented by the governor, did not address catastrophic oil spill at all. In the House Resources It was not deductible. A catastrophic oil spill was not deductible. The language was taken out of the Senate version. And similarly, in this CS before you, it does not include language prohibiting the deduction of any costs associated with a catastrophic oil spill. Now, in that, I would just point out a couple of things. One is a catastrophic oil spill is defined by statute, and it's very large. I believe it's about half of the size of the Exxon Valdez spill. And the other thing is that the language that was incorporated into the House Resources CS talked about a spill into inland waters or marine waters, I believe. The language has been taken out, prohibiting the deduction, which means the general rule would be that it would be deductible. Now, I would just note that one of the items that is not an allowed expense is any expenditure that's incurred through fraud or negligence, and that is a specific general disallowed expenditure under 160D2. So what that means is we're left with the conclusion that this oil spill could be deductible if it's on the lease, that is direct to the lease, and it's not through either fraud or negligence having been incurred. So I just wanted to flag that item for people.
Mr. Chairman, your provision.
If I could supplement that response. Just in general, it's very important to understand, in understanding how this bill is intended to work. The list of items in 160D2 that are not deductible is not an exhaustive list. In other words, it's not true that if a cost is not listed in the exclusions, that it's therefore deductible. Those are simply examples of particular types of costs that, for policy reasons or for clarity, the legislature would say flat out they're not deductible. If it's not listed in there, then you basically go back to the fundamental definition of what's deductible, which is direct, ordinary, necessary cost of exploring for producing or developing or producing oil and gas. And so when Robin says that cleanup costs for spills would in some cases be deductible, that's not because they're not listed as an exclusion. It's because under the general interpretation of direct, ordinary, necessary, they would in some cases be deductible.
Mr. Turner?
So the state would still have to be participating under the 470 fund to help clean up these spills, right? I mean, we can ask DEC about this too. I mean, I don't know. I think that this is an area that we should be real clear about. Otherwise, I can think Mr. Mintz is going to have lots of work in the future to deal with it. Thanks.
Okay. There was additional language in the Senate version that provided that where there's exploration credits being taken, that DNR would get the exploration information. That is language that was taken directly from what is currently in statute in 025. And that was believed to be an improvement, and so that language has been incorporated in the House Finance CS. There was also a slight improvement in language in 020F, that is the sales language, and I'll draw your attention to that as we walk through the bill in a few minutes. And then there also was additional clarifying language that's listed on here as NPSL regs after industry practice. The bill had two provisions that the department would give substantial weight to industry standards and so on, and what was unclear was sort of the hierarchy of those two provisions, and so the language has been added to clarify that, and I'll flag that as we go through the bill. So that walks us through the matrix, which I saw as sort of being the high points. I may point out additional provisions as we go through the bill, but we tried to capture the main pieces on the matrix.
Thank you.
Are we going to get another comparison that includes the Senate Resources version of the bill?
We could probably get one to put that in if you would like it.
I'd like that. Thank you.
Okay, then with that, I'd like to sort of walk through the bill itself. I think we've covered many of the points, but I just would draw your attention to a few things as we go through. Thank you. On page 2 of the bill, lines 16 through 25 was intent language that was added in the Senate version, and it was intent language added to show the intent that DEC reduce program costs regarding the spill fund. Flipping over then to page 3, line 29, you see the general tax rate of 20%. Page 4, lines 23 through 31 is the start of the progressivity. It also then carries over to the next page. And within subsection G, then we see the, on line 29, we see the slope factor of 0.25%. And if you go over to the next page, then on line 2, 35 is the trigger point, and 35 is the net value. So you calculate your net value, divide it by barrels of equivalent, and that comes up to a net value per barrel. That's compared against 35 to come up with the what's called the price index. The next area of interest here are lines 7 through 26. And this deals with Cook Inlet gas, which you may recall I mentioned earlier. On lines 9 and 13, I will note that there was a typographical error in there, which you'll see an amendment to correct. The intent there is to not to exceed 19 cents per MCF. And so the rest of it is providing a formula to divide the net tax by the barrels of equivalent to come up with the sort of as-if tax per barrel. That's compared to 19 cents. And then basically it's the lower of. The 19 cents was taken from March actual tax amounts paid based on the March average gas ELF in Cook Inlet and using the 10% statutory tax rate. Did you want to go into it further at this point? Or?
Representative Schall, through the chair, another brief descriptor here, what the rest of the, what sort of the section J through K, or lines 14 through 26 do, is it simply a formula that because we are at net, we simply can't say, gee, what was this MCF taxed at? What we need to do is we need to look at the average tax rate that any taxpayer has, takes the full value, looks at it, and then breaks it down, says, okay, if that average applied to an MCF of gas in Cook Inlet, what would it do? As we have analyzed this last night and this morning, there are some shifts that go on in terms of value, and we'll probably propose to you or see if we can interest someone in looking at different ways of making it that same calculation. I think again, we haven't had a lot of time to analyze it, but as we look at it, the formula here might do some things when prices are at extremes. And well, fortunately, in some ways, we're at a price extreme now at $72.
Okay, then. Page 6, Section 7, that's lines 6 through 18, that is the safe harbor with the annual true-up. And so you'll see on line 6, it says 95%. Flipping over to page 8, line 2. You will find the credit rate of 20%. That's the CapEx credit rate. And then on lines 12 through 29 is the language that I talked about earlier where the Department of Natural Resources gets the exploration data. Over to page 10. Starting at the bottom of the page, starting at lines 30 and 31, that's where the transitional provisions, the two-for-one, begins, and it carries over to the next page. It carries on, I think, onto page 12. So if we then look at page 11 of that, we see it's a five-year look back, and that shows up on lines 1 and 2. And the 2-for-1 then is contained in lines 13 through 19. The 7-year sunset and the fact that it's a rolling sunset is contained in lines 22 through 28 of that same page 11.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might just describe what we understand the rolling sunset means, is that if there's a company that had come to the state and was investing, right now is in the process of investing, let's say they were going to keep investing for 2 or 3 years before they had any production, the way this would work is they would be in a position when they could actually reclaim their transitional investment expenditures. They wouldn't be having any production to claim them against, so they'd be, there's a 7-year window, and let's say they didn't actually start to have income that they could claim that against for profits until the last 2 years, they would be squeezed out. So the intent was, I think, and the mechanics of it work that way, is that if you are investing, let's say you've invested 2 years before the effective date of the bill, and then you invest for another 2 years, you'll take your transitional investment expenditures and you can reclaim them over the first 7 years of production. So it basically takes a new producer and puts them on the same footing as someone who was producing when the bill became effective.
Okay, then going on to page 12, lines 4 through 17, I would draw your attention to, that was not on the matrix. This language was taken from the Senate version, and it's where a producer receives a credit on a facility that's subject to regulation by the FERC, that the producer will basically support all rate proceedings such that the credit will be accounted for in FERC setting tariffs. There is a piece that's in the Senate version that is not here, and that specifically was about, they had language about auditing this. We saw that as a little bit of a problem because the state has general auditing powers under the administrative provisions, and to have sort of almost duplicate language but not quite in this provision sets up the question, how is it different and why is it different? And so we, you know, our suggestion was to rely on the basic audit powers for which we could use to investigate this as well. So that particular audit language that's in the Senate version is not in here.
Thank you. I recognize this language came from a floor amendment in the Senate, but I fully understand the point about a FERC-regulated facility and having to take a position on any rate filing proceedings. That makes all the sense in the world to me. But it's Section 2 that I'm struggling with. Section 2, obviously, you two, I see you nodding. You know what the question coming is. I guess I don't understand why you got two, applying it also to any circumstance where there's an arm's length transaction going on between two commercial parties negotiating for a service. And here we're making a definitive statement that somehow one of those parties, the selling party, has to discount the cost of providing those services in regards to this credit. We're specifically saying you must discount the cost of the services you're providing in the negotiation you're conducting with this other party. And when, quite frankly, I'm sitting here with Rep. Samuels negotiating for the use of his aircraft, I really don't care that he's got a federal tax credit for purchasing his aircraft. He puts it in his matrix, and he's negotiating with me because there's another, the world's out there for me to be making a make or buy decision myself. I guess I just don't understand why we're creating this restriction on two independent third-party commercial parties in their internal negotiations. Is not the market self-regulating?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, I'll let others speak to whether the market is self-regulating. It's very small, but you've clearly identified the problem, which is you've got a price that passes between two parties, and what this would be asking is for us to come in and audit that price and try to establish the element and the absence or presence of 100% of some element. So I absolutely agree with your concerns, and particularly I would have framed them as we're not sure what this is a command for. It says that as a condition of receiving, you will do this. We're not sure what happens if you demonstrate that you haven't done it. We're not sure how we would demonstrate that you haven't done it. And whatever it is, 100% credit probably makes it very hard to demonstrate that you have done it. So we understand your concerns. I do think part of the issue was, as you said, one is fairly clear, and there was some notion that, well, regulated and non-regulated should be treated the same. But I agree with the concerns you've expressed that this is probably not the way to try to create that equality.
I guess I would just add, you've got one party receiving a credit that seems to be said it has to be considered, but it doesn't say anything about having actually realized value for that credit either. So, they say fraught with peril is what this language is.
For just a moment, you're absolutely right. In also strictly enforced, it is pretty onerous because if the one party passes through 99% of the credit, not the 1%, then 100% of the credit can be disallowed.
And does this mean we have to interpose the Department of Revenue in every commercial transaction that occurs in the industry?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, certainly if every transaction involving the physical assets which have received a credit, which would be most physical assets in our flow.
Seems to me we got a fiscal note here that means, that's $1 billion of audit costs a year to get in there, but we will be back to this, I'm sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, maybe there's some history on this amendment that I don't understand because it seems almost conceptual. We're trying to give the consumer the break here. And beyond that, I don't know how it practically works.
Representative Weirach, through the chair, I think that's correct in the sense that if you, as Representative Hawker said, if you set up a regulated facility and you have the pages of regulations to say here's the cost of service, then you can do that transaction. But typically, if you're trying to regulate a facility, if you're trying to regulate costs, you have to regulate costs. You can't just say that has to pass through. So, fair observation.
Sorry, I defended you. Kidding.
Representative Pula.
On the other hand, couldn't the companies just come in and show you how they're taking, they're not going to charge someone for something that they didn't pay? I mean, that's really where this is getting to. It's a credit, so they didn't pay it, so someone else certainly shouldn't have to pay it if they didn't. I mean, that's the effort here. Couldn't they come in and simply, file with you guys, show you the evidence that they haven't charge somebody something that they themselves didn't have to pay and be done with it? I mean, it doesn't seem that onerous to me.
Representative Petrullo, through the chair, unless you regulate their profits and their rate of return, and all other aspects and how every cost is passed through, then one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to set up the entire regulatory structure, or else you turn to a paper exercise. They say, gosh, I'm going to charge somebody $2 a barrel to go through this facility. My credit works out to 25 cents, so I'll send a piece of paper to the Department of Revenue that says I would have charged them $2.25, but I got the credit, so I'm charging them $2. So it seems to me either you turn it into a silly exercise, or you have to go the full nine yards. As you know, as you're well aware, FERC and RCA, and people can sort of roll their eyes and joke, you know, make the jokes, but they have 5- and 10-year rate cases because you go through every element and you work it through and you make sure it fits together like a jigsaw puzzle.
Well, I'm not sure how, you know, important this is to the smaller explorers, but I would imagine that they'd feel it was pretty silly that they had to pay for something that the other company didn't. I mean, that's what it's getting at. So I don't know how we work it out, but there has to be some fairness here that the, you know, people don't get charged something that the underlying company didn't.
Through the chair, I think you're making Representative Weirach's point. That may be a very good goal. What I'm suggesting is this particular paragraph doesn't give the Department of Revenue the kind of tools that they would need to do anything moderately approaching achieving your goal.
And that's probably a very fair statement. I'm worried about the tools that you don't have throughout this bill. Thank you.
Representative Kelly.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Rob.
Okay. So on page 12, looking at the bottom of the page on lines 30 and 31, there's some old language that's been removed. This is consistent with what was in the Senate version. And then on to page 13.
If I might, that language being removed was a sunset provision. And what's happening now is the effect of SB 185, which created a series of exploration-only credits, is now being extended, and so some conditions that were attached to those for time are being removed.
Okay, then over to page 13. Line 16 is where the 10-year extension for SB 185 credits is contained. Going on to page 15. The amendments that are contained on lines 19 to 28 are amendments to current language to fix the current statutory problem on the $20 million Cook Inlet credit. And I'd be happy to explain that if anybody has questions on that.
Mr. Chair, could I ask you to explain that?
Representative Hawker.
Okay, thank you. Could you just to explain why this fixes the problem and how it does it?
Yes. The original intent was that there would be no additional credit certificates granted if Cook Inlet credits reached $20 million. But the way that the statutory language turned out was that credits would not be granted, didn't say in Cook Inlet, once the Cook Inlet credits were $20 million. So you could read that language to mean that there would be no credits anywhere on that if the Cook Inlet was at 20. And so that's been fixed here. And did
it's a matter of policy
and
call.
And the other problem was the current language doesn't say what happens or how it's handled if that $20 million happens in October. How do you decide which explorer during the year got that credit? Do you allocate it between the explorers that did work or what? And so this sets up what we see as a more fair approach, which is after the end of the calendar year following year. So once it reaches $20 million, then they have another year basically to be on notice that the credit is sunsetting.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And this isn't a policy question that I don't have an answer to, but in that, you know, we essentially do not have a cap on North Slope exploration credits, a dollar cap. Is it good policy to be putting a dollar cap at all on exploration credits in the Cook Inlet? I think, as we all know, South Central communities are facing the exhaustion of their gas supplies. I'm not so sure that it's good policy to constrain exploration efforts in that part of the state.
All right, then moving on to page 19. Section 25 is the language that allows the department to allow the use of RSA values, and this is the part that I mentioned earlier we believe needs some amendment to include the provision placing the responsibility on the department to determine that it is cost effective and looks at actual costs and does not understate tax liability.
That's quite all right, Mr. Chairman. A lot going on. You know, on this one, you referenced that your sort of direction you were going with the solution was to go back to the language that had been in a previous Senate version that had been, again, removed in the process. And when we got this back together, I understand drafting, but I know the language you're referring to, and it talked about the bias of lowering tax collections. I certainly support the concept, but I would ask that you take, I'm not going to be able to support the exact language you had previously. I think it needs to be more fleshed out, more thoroughly considered. But you know, I agree with the idea, but I hope we come back together with something more than just the language that was there before, because I don't think that's going to withstand the test of legislative scrutiny.
Sure, we'd certainly like to work with you on that so we can get something that meets your concerns.
Thank you.
Okay, flipping over then to page 20.
Representative Kelly.
Just on that last issue, we've had a lot of shaking on it by a lot of terriers, and so we don't just go shake on it again. I guess we've kind of got a world view between the trying to figure out how to leave the RSA stuff in there, and then you've got what I'll call the terrier view. And I saw him going, I think I've heard enough of the debate to where I'd say probably, and maybe then this fellow over here saying, that I'd probably think we got there. Is there some way we can get there without having another big, long discussion of it? I'd sure like to see that. But that would be my test of we probably got there.
Representative Kelly, through the chair, we can certainly try to include as many folks who are interested, because we would very much like to get language that makes this concept work for everyone.
Thank
so
you.
We will go to a wider circle.
Thank you.
And just on that point, I would say that the good senator and I would be in complete agreement when we found agreement on this one, and probably not until then.
Okay. Thank you. Here.
Okay. On to page 20. So lines 8 and 9, which starts subparagraph capital B, one-third of the gross value at the point of production of the gas, that is the GRE that came from the Senate version. And then right above it, lines 6 through 8, are the value exclusion that is for cooking lit oil in this bill, in this version of the bill. So in this version, less 3/4 of the gross value at the point of production of the oil from leases or property in the Cook Inlet sedimentary basin. Okay, page 22.
Representative Kelly.
I just want to weigh in with continuing problems on that I think we've got to grapple with. It's a real challenge to cover the slope, Cook Inlet, the Nana Basin, Bristol, Yukon Flats, and all of them. And it's a real struggle to cover. We want the little guys to get out there and keep going, and yet if they strike 3 TCF somewhere or another, half a billion barrels somewhere, we don't want to have put that rate in and locked it in. Accidentally, so I guess I just think rather than let this go by without any comment, that I think we've got a lot of talking to do about this problem. The other thing is mixing and matching between a community or a community subsidy, energy subsidy, that works okay in one spot, but just to pick on my neck of the woods, if we hit it big in the Nana Basin, how are we supposed to handle that? Our community is heated with oil. There's royalty oil that comes through Fairbanks. That's handled differently from what is proposed here. It's just, I think we've got some things to chew on. Propane could be going downriver. Should we be building something in that someday makes sense for that? Or at the end of the day, are many of these things so difficult to anticipate that are out there are ways that we might ought to look at the inlet, for example, and look at the current rate, see what it's doing. I just want to say I think we've got some work to do. Thank you.
There's been a call placed on the House, so we will stand at ease to call of the chair.